Welcome to The Restless Shifty, a podcast highlighting the eclectic legacy of Shifty Records, South Africa's fiercely independent cult record label operating through the dark days of apartheid into the democratic era. I'm Warwick Sony.
And I'm Lloyd Ross. Each episode features a classic album from our catalogue. Today, Guma by The Genuines.
And it's the album they did that isn't actually Guma. It's more of a rock album. The Guma album was called Mr. Mac and the Genuines.
Ah, but there's a different Warwick. The spelling of the word. They dropped the H.
They did drop the H.
Just a quick heads up here. Guma refers to a sound that comes from the Cape Province in South Africa, when troops of minstrels go around the city playing a very specific kind of music, which you'll only hear in Cape Town. Guma, more specifically, refers to the drum that is beaten during these parades around the city. Usually Guma is spelled G-H-O-E-M-A. The name of the album is G-O-E-M-A. And in that, I think maybe they were trying to say something.
They were. In fact, when we spoke to Hilton...
Oh, we went to have a chat the other day?
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe at this stage, just describe the band quickly. It was Mac McKenzie on bass guitar and vocals, Hilton Schilder on keyboard, percussion and vocals, Ian Herman on drums, and Gerard O'Brien on guitar. Mac and Hilton composed all the band's original material. Okay, Warwick, you were saying?
Hilton, he was talking about how they developed the Guma thing in the same way. I think he even mentioned, or it might have been Mac, who mentioned that they, when they went to Joburg, somebody played them the Specials and ska and all that, and they knew that they had a music form that was to South Africa what ska was to Jamaica or to the colony England, the colonizer England.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Well, you know what I mean, the Jamaicans in England, actually, yes. The revival of ska.
The diaspora.
Yeah. So in a way, Guma should have been to, I guess, Cape Town, the way the Genuines were playing it, the new Guma. But they were the only band who could do it. Because it's so bloody difficult and it's so fast.
Yeah, that's true. I was kind of wondering, did they actually sort of put a times two on the way they played in the Genuines band, do you think? Or do you think it's that fast generally in the culture?
It's a good point. Because that banjo swings along. I mean, even that
it
version.
It is actually, you're talking about the banjo, I think you're right.
Yeah. I wanted to just go back to the Guma with the H and the Guma without the H and the significance of that. And actually in.
Yeah, these are very important things to clear up in the beginning, I think, Warwick.
Very
the Guma with the H
yeah.
and the Guma without the
without
H.
Without the H. And I think Valmont Lane in his thesis for his PhD, well, he wrote this. He actually mentions the H quite a big thing. He says, two celebrated local theatre producers, Talib Peterson and David Kramer, have made considerable impact in popularising Guma by producing a string of hugely popular shows, including the titled musical Guma. This is with an H. In this body of work, its rendition as Guma with an H evokes its archaic form. So what Velman is talking about is the archaic form of Guma going back to the days of slavery and the Alabama, Dar Kumdi Alabama, that period. But then he says, on the contrary, the Genuines dropped the letter H, and given its immersion with punk, in this case, this rendition, Guma, without the H, is phonographic. No trace of carnival beginnings or 19th century vaudeville theatre is evident in the Genuines. Instead, as the Genuines espouse it, Guma, without the H, was contemporary, a statement of youthful modernity. I like that. A statement of youthful modernity, purposeful but likely to prove hard to harness for political purposes. This is a difficult thing, and I think why the Genuines kind of battled with the form and trying to get it popular, because the National Party prior to that had tried to, with the idea of own affairs and cultural affairs, you know, they tried to make that almost the Cape sound, you know, the carnival and the coons and all that.
This is probably something that we'll come back to, because I think we're going to do another episode on the second album, which is Mr. Mac and the Genuines. But just quickly to deal with that, I remember taking these albums when we were trying to publicize it in the Cape here to Radio Good Hope, where I took the Mr. Mac album.
Yeah, and just for the listeners, the Mr. Mac album was the proper Guma album.
Proper Guma
rock crossover with Mac's father as the banjo player. He gave it the authenticity.
Yeah. So when we tried to market that, we took it around to Radio Good Hope. And just to explain further Warwick's point about the apartheid radio station. So essentially the policy of the National Party was to give each language its own radio station. So complete separation again of cultures. You know, Sotho would have their own radio station, Zulu would have, Pedi would have their own radio station, etc., etc. But there wasn't really a radio station for the coloured people in the Cape. And I suppose that's another phrase I should clear up here. We're going to call coloured people, like Mac and Hilton call themselves coloured people, as opposed to so-called coloured people. So just to continue, there wasn't really a radio station for coloured people, but in the Cape, the regional radio was called Radio Good Hope, and that's where we took the Mr. Mac album to try and get it played.
It's amazing they couldn't see the brilliance.
The brilliance of it.
Yeah.
They weren't prepared to listen to it because it sounded like Klopsa.
Yeah.
Basically, the minstrel sound.
Really?
Yeah.
But the coloured folk were left out in that way. It wasn't seen as something that you would promote in the way that apartheid government promoted Zulu culture or Sotho, you know, with the divisions. And they ignored the Afrikaans, the fact that they were a contributor and the main foundation of Afrikaans language. And that's, I think, why the genuines were important. And a lot of people at UWC, for them, the genuines were it. They were the cultural force that just shot forward and said, this is what we are, this is the sound, and it's us, and, you know, own it.
Yeah, well, that's today, Warwick.
Yeah.
But back in the day, it wasn't like that. Max got a version of playing at the University of Western Cape back in probably 1988, where they weren't that well accepted.
One night we were playing at the UWC, a huge UDF rally. The people come up and they perform their stuff, Amandla, and one after the other they come. Now's a genuine time to come and play. Me, I already got my T-shirt off. You know me, it's a genuine signature. Hilton, Gerard, myself, and Ian, and my dad is sitting there going to play the banjo. As we wander onto stage, there's a fucker that runs to the microphone and says, "Comrades, comrades, Amandla! Amandla!"
Yeah, you throw at the rock of the
They say, "Comrades, comrades, this is the genuines. They play rock for the white people, and we are here in the struggle. Down with the genuines!" The whole crowd shout, "Down with the genuines!"
Yeah, that was at UWC.
They about to take out the fucking tires to necklace us because they're militant. It's mad. I hope you're recording this. They are mad. They are militant. And he doesn't stop. He says, "Yeah, the genuines are in Johannesburg playing for the white people. And it's hunting on." Man, my dad is just like this to me. I told you, we are in shit here. I'm also getting fucking worried.
Because
my T-shirt is off. I'm ready to go play a fucking set. Out of the corner come Mzwaki. Whoop! Mzwaki take that microphone away from that fucking arsehole and says, "Comrades, comrades, Amandla." Now they see Mzwaki. They say, "Amandla." He says, "The genuines is the best band to bring your culture forward. Mzwaki come and save our skins." But not just to save our skins, he says, "These guys are singing protest songs. What's this man on about rock? The genuines can play rock. The genuines can play jazz." Mzwaki gave them a fucking lecture at length.
He gave them a real tongue.
By the time we got onto the stage, oh, the struggle, the whole place was bouncing.
That crowd was getting ugly, you see.
No, they really didn't like us. I mean, it's a UWC.
Before they even introduced us, and a lot of them didn't even know who we were.
Colored people, my bro.
What the fuck?
Yeah,
that's a colored dude stoking up the colored people to hate us because we got white fans.
And because we're playing rock.
But fuck, did we have a narrow escape?
Sweet.
Okay, well, let's go back to when did you record it, Lloyd? You recorded the band. You saw them playing at Jameson's.
Well, first, I think maybe what we should do is we'll talk about the impression that Genuines gave us the first time we saw them. When do you remember seeing them for the first time?
I saw them playing in Jameson's, the club that we all went to that had the Paul Kruger license, and it was non-racial.
Which was a very, very rare thing in South Africa.
A very rare thing?
A very, very, very rare thing in South Africa. I think there were two pubs in Joburg that had it. So whites and black could actually mingle together in a social atmosphere and they could drink.
They could drink and they could entertain. Yeah. They could play, you could have concerts, could do anything. Up until then, you know, because of punk and new wave and the kind of art kind of music that we were involved, post-punk really was that era. Most of us were semi-professional, you could say. We had jobs and we learned to play music amongst ourselves. And then when I saw the Genuines play, it blew me away, but not only me, everyone, because of their mastery of the instruments. They were proper musicians playing the kind of music we loved. I suppose the fact that they played so effortlessly, Mac on bass would sing. For a modern band, he sort of almost seemed like he was channeling like the 70s, but doing it.
Yeah, almost like Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah. I thought of a cross between Jimi Hendrix and Phil Lynott from Thin Lizzy, you know.
Oh, right, yeah.
He had that vibe.
And like them, he didn't have to look at his fingers like we had to do when we played.
He never looked at his fingerboard, ever. Yeah. He sang just and looked at the audience. And they played this blistering rock, kind of punk, jazz, and gumma. Came through in the rhythms, and the interesting thing was that the speed of the drumming, Ian Herman, the drummer, had adapted gumma beats that they'd programmed into a TR-909 drum machine, and that was the core of the rhythm section, you could say. Apparently, when they met Ian for the first time and they played, they had a
set. You know
what,
Warwick, I've got a little clip of Mac describing exactly that.
No, so what happened was when I finally met Ian, and he came to listen to this music in the flat in Boekstraat. And he burst out laughing and he said he was bored. Now his potential could be realized with what we played on the TR-909 because we made the rhythms on that, what we pictured.
Yeah.
And Hilton was our technician. So I used to say to Hilton what I require, Hilton used to put what he required, and then we had the perfect fucking drum beat that we could play through.
Yeah, pause it there, Lloyd, that's brilliant.
Essentially...
That is the core of the Genuines. You realize that no one knows this.
Yes. Hey? It's the TR-909.
The TR-909 and Hilton programming and Hilton being a percussionist, actually.
Exactly. Before he played keyboards, he was a percussionist.
In fact, you even said the other day, if you had to hire a percussionist, the first person you'd go to be him.
It would be.
Yeah.
He's got such an innate sense of rhythm.
And the amazing thing is that Ian then was inspired by that programming and translated it into live, and that became almost his style.
And, you know, they'd given up on finding a drummer that could do that.
Yeah.
And then they found Ian. I think this is the last piece of the jigsaw puzzle. The three of them, Mac McKenzie on bass guitar, Hilton Schilder on keyboards, Gerard O'Brien on guitar, and the TR-909 came up to Joburg.
That's right.
And then Ian joined the band. Then it was the Genuines that we know.
suddenly, with that energy of a live drummer, they just moved. I mean, they moved people because of the sweat and the accuracy of playing. It was just insane. It was like you'd think they were going to fall off.
My lasting impression of seeing that band for the first time was just the energy.
Yeah.
I mean, forget the music. It was just this vibrant thing that was emanating from these four individuals. Excellent players with the engine room just cooking behind. That was the genuines for me.
And the fastest song, I think, was that song, Guma. Going back to Velmond Lane's thesis, he says the genuines harness the effective force of Guma, the slave carnival rhythm, within a revitalized cultural politics in which intensity is fulminated. I draw the following lyrics from a fast punk rock song called Guma. The song, a drum, guitar and bass driven riff on a single chord, proceeds at over 300 beats per minute, with McKenzie exploiting his rich vocal grain. Guma, Guma! And then he quotes the lyric, late at night, someone takes a drum and we go, guma, 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 guma. And that's the lyric. Oh, of course. And then the last refrain is, you take the right decision in the right direction.
This is always important,
yeah.
Warwick.
Yeah.
take the right decision in the right direction. So anyway, even though you and I shared a studio, we didn't really work together that much. You know, I had my projects and you had your projects. But I think a lot of my A&R used to be done at Jamison's.
Yeah.
Just to go there, check out the bands. It was like such a hotbed of creativity, people playing original music I'm talking about here. I mean, there were bands playing around Joburg, Cape Town and Durban doing cover versions. And this is the one, in fact, maybe we should get Mac and Hilton's point of view on why they came to Joburg. And it had a lot to do with cover versions.
I was just going to say, yeah, we should just give a sense of what they came out of, because in those days, their peer group molded themselves as musicians all around cover versions. No one played original material. And particularly Hilton and Mac both articulate very well their frustration with that environment and the fact that their own music, they couldn't perform it in Cape Town, really. So they came up to Joburg.
We came from a shit background. Mm. We had to earn our daily bread playing cover fucking versions. You can't believe how horrible that world is. The other musicians in Cape Town, they had a habit of booking us because we had the skill to play any song. We could play Chick Corea, Jimi Hendrix. We could play any fucking thing. I was booked as a bass player. Jared was booked as a guitar player. Hilton was booked as a piano player. You this cover version mercenary. But we had to take it. It was agony. It was agony living in Cape Town as a talented musician and composer and having to just play this. It made me weep. I just said, I'm stopping. In the meantime, I'm figuring to myself, hey, man, I've been in Johannesburg. That rock scene that I've saw there is way more attractive than this. And some instinct in me tells me, I've got to make my way to Joburg. And for a whole year, I sat there and wrote this repertoire. And Gerard is living with me. So we're getting the fucking rock riffs together. Crazy summer. Crazy summer. Hilton comes in, we show him, we got this, show him, we got that. But in the meantime, tonight, he must go play with those other Nayas because he has to support his family. I don't have to support them. My mind is on Yovo, Rock Street. Where I see punks. I know my music is going to go down. Oh,
So that's basically why they came to Joburg. It's quite interesting, Warwick, because, I mean, if you remember, you and I cut our teeth on the original music scene in Cape Town.
Yeah,
so this is quite.
Right.
This is 1980, 1981.
You mean before we did the recordings?
Yeah,
even
before I got the studio together.
The Cape Town was the happening place for certainly for the post-punk.
So I think it just shows again the apartheid kind of society we were living in. So these guys were coming from a coloured community. We were coming from a white community where people actually were writing original compositions, and there were places you could go and play, but they didn't intersect with.
Yeah.
Mac and Hilton's community at all.
Exactly. The demand in their community wasn't for that sort of music. Mm. So they, interestingly, were one of the first crossovers. And they got criticized for it too. They, at this point, they moved from the colored community into the Joburg white rock scene.
In a way, I guess there was more of a blurring of the color bar in Joburg and in the music scene there.
And the only other band like them were National Wake, who were playing rock.
Yeah.
And they were a mixed band.
And of course, like Chaluka.
Yeah, of course. So these were happening, and Winston's Jive Mix.
Yeah.
And all those bands we've just mentioned were incredibly important. They also had a seventh single.
Persuasions.
With Hilton's interview. Mm. He said they did a seventh single called Persuasions, which neither you nor I had ever come across. So anyone listening out there has a copy.
Yeah,
rare collectors. Adam sent it to us, or at least a recording of it. And the other interesting thing was Mac and Hilton, what I found fascinating also is that their parents were musicians. Not only were their parents musicians, they were very, very good professional musicians, because Hilton comes from the Schulder family, of which there are like five or six that are quite well known in the music industry.
This is Hilton's dad, Tony, with his trio.
Both Mac and Hilton, but mainly Mac, spoke about his influences, which I find very interesting. So his dad was a musician, plays banjo, and he came from a musical family. But his dad worked at Gallo Records as a packer, and he got these free records that he'd brought home. They were a very eclectic mix of stuff. Schoenberg, things like that. So it'd be classical music, it'd be jazz, with a lot of rock. And then Mac also said Springbok Radio. And that was like a huge influence, just listening to the rock music on Springbok Radio.
It was for all of us.
And Hilton also said Springbok Radio,
Yeah, and what else was there to listen to?
And it was Tuya Tala.
Or Radio Bantu.
And it was mostly classic sort of Makanga music
Great, the bass that you love to
great
play.
Great bass players. That's where I grew up with my bass playing.
Exactly.
Came from, I did love the
I also have such fond memories of that sound.
Yeah.
You know, that Makanga sound.
And that goes back to, I suppose, a whole other story, which was the radio, South Africa apartheid radio and how it worked. Some people say probably the only good thing about apartheid was all those radio stations had to have content. So there's a big investment in Zulu and Sotho for all the different, you know, but they didn't. It didn't apply to Cape Town. Anyway, they did come from these musical families.
They did.
And Mr. Mac was no slouch on the banjo.
He wasn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was very respected banjo player, I believe.
One, two, three.
But we'll speak more about Mr. Mac in the next podcast with the album that was centered around him, Mr. Mac and the
Generals. Okay, yeah. I've got a note, goodbye, Kevin.
No, we probably shouldn't put that
in. No, we won't put that in.
No.
And then they came up to Joburg, and as Hilton describes, in Mac's Boer auntie's combi. Oh, no, it was an Audi.
They
drove up, Mac's girlfriend Erna,
who
Hilton describes as a Boer auntie. They all drove up in the Audi. And you've got to give it to the Genuines. They were survivors, man. They got to Joburg, they had nothing. They stayed at some guy's flat, Johnny Rodriguez, owner of the Box Street flat. I think I first met them there. It was quite a big place, I seem to recall.
It was a hectic corner, though.
Hectic.
It's like Vice Central.
Vice Central, and they loved it. They were into the drugs, they were into everything.
Yeah.
They were basically just into it. They loved Joburg, they loved rock and roll. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I mean, they were...
That was all there.
They were the biggest exponents of that philosophy.
Corner of Bock and Courts. Vice Central. Sex and drugs and rock and roll.
Yeah.
They provided the rock and roll.
And Hilton said the first gig was at the Black Sun with the TR-909
before
Ian. Yeah, yeah.
From the same chat that I had with Mac before he died, Mac and Hilton actually got them together after the little festival up the West Coast. And I spoke to them for a couple of hours on camera. This is one of the things from it. He's describing Jamison's.
Oh. But Ian then one day said to us, there's a place called Jamison's. So when we get onto the stage, there's one guy that shouts, oh!
Cape Town.
Oh, Cape Town, you bunch of bushes, you're going to play Algera. So we thought, okay, that is very artful, we can play. So the first four bars we played, the crowd fucked off, they vanished.
Because we wanted to play Cape Jazz, not Cape Jazz, but it was a phrase, it was a
impressive. Then I stopped the band in the middle of the next verse.
I shouted
one. I said, one crazy summer. Dun, 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 dun. They all came running back. And that was it.
And then, I'll never forget that moment. It's etched in my memory.
And then when we finished that set, Herbert Schufmeyer stands there. He says, no, I'm not paying you.
Herbert is the owner of Jamison. Is this the track? Wow.
He says, I want you guys to play another set.
That's right. Hey, that was our first gig.
I pay you double. I said, cool, now what are we going to do about chow? He says, hey, steak and chips, anything you like. Royalty, immediately.
Hey, we were really fucking hustling.
We had no food in our stomach. We were struggling. Just before that, we were sitting there in Book Street, really down and out. Was our link to the Joburg scene. Everybody knew Ian Herman. So one day Ian said, there's a guy, his name is Lloyd Ross. He's got a thing called Shifty Records. He wants to record us. I said, wow, that's cool. So Lloyd pulls in with his caravan, standing in Commissioner Street. The cables are running. The cables are running inside. The microphones are there.
Was that the first recording?
Yes. It was a live recording.
Wow, Lloyd, this is amazing. We have to definitely put this out, man. I've never heard this.
You know how many times I paid studios to go and make recordings? Believing in myself. Take my own money.
Yeah.
Hire Hilton and them. Everybody give you money. And then this man comes up and says, let's do an album.
The thing that I can't understand is that these guys consistently smoke buttons like for I don't know how many years in their life. And they can remember this stuff like it was yesterday, and I can't remember this at all.
Yeah, but Lloyd, bear in mind that what Hilton said, that he didn't read music, and he trained his memory. I mean, he had to remember, and especially now, the kind of music he plays now is like classical music. He remembers it all.
So it's
the muscle you train, that's all.
Yeah, but what about Mac?
did Mac read? Yeah, he did. He wrote.
Did
late,
he taught himself to read because he wanted to be a composer.
No, but they had amazing memories. I mean, the recall of stories, too.
Yeah.
I mean, they really, and detail, too. I mean, there's a lot of, Hilton said the other day, he said that he and Mac were like nitro and glycerine. You remember that? Yeah. Such a wonderful.
There was that explosion when they got together.
Yeah.
That was beautiful.
And that what you just played now was like, damn, that is burning up the rubber.
Do you remember that song or not? No.
I haven't heard it.
There's a whole live album there. We should put it out.
We've got to put that live album out. I've got to listen to it. I mean, I've never heard it. Yeah, so they and the other thing about going back to the White Pipes, which is Mandrax. Mandrax makes you very, very slow. And they used to, that was their kind of drug of choice. You mix Mandrax with marijuana, smoke it, and that's the White Pipe.
But Ian never smoked buttons.
Ian never did.
In fact, he used to have something on one of his drum cases. There's a sticker. It said, buttonheads are muttonheads.
That's right. Yeah, he had that sticker, a very poignant sticker. But Hilton the other day said, no, but when they played rock music, they never smoked before they went on stage.
Yeah.
Only for jazz.
Yeah.
So that's quite interesting.
No, he basically said, with that Ian Herman machine going behind you, you would die if you try and play that speed of music.
Yeah, because if you fell off the railway line,
yeah,
you couldn't get back on the train.
That's it, yeah. Yeah.
It'd just carry on without you.
Apparently they did it once.
Is it?
And it really didn't work.
Yeah. Can imagine, eh?
Anyway, there's a nice little clip I'll play later in the podcast as well about them speaking about the button culture, where it came from and that kind of thing.
Okay, so we've got this drugs thing which sets up the bad boy. Hilton mentioned that a number of times, that we were the bad boys. In fact, Mac was the bad boy. I remember Hilton saying that his dad didn't want him to go with Mac.
No, Mac had to ask permission.
He had to ask permission. Because everyone was a...
But also for Gerard.
I was going to say.
Yeah.
Hilton mentioned Gerard and said that they couldn't get permission.
He was a good Christian boy.
Yeah. And then there was some sort of a exchange of some sort.
There was, yeah.
I couldn't quite work that out that Gerard could go. And it all had to do with Mac's reputation.
Yeah, but this was before the Genuines.
It was before the Genuines, yeah. But it became the Genuines. Yeah. We now...
How are we gathering the members of the band? Headhunting.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Because they were youngsters, basically fresh out of school.
Oh, he said Gerard was a Catholic boy.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that was... But they were exceptional musicians, which is why Mac wanted to... Mac's a good maybe 8 years older than
yeah,
Hilton.
That's right, yeah.
So he was almost the next generation, but he recognized the talent in these youngsters.
And then they had friends in the drug world too. Hilton pointed out a song lyric.
Oh, right.
And it had like an Eastern melody. Then Hilton said, oh, that song's about, you know, there's something about it carrying a heavy load. And it was some guy who got bust. That's right, he was selling heroin and then he decided to do it on his own. And he got caught in Turkey and he was like 8 years in jail. But he had it quite cool because he had his own kitchen. Sounded like that horrific movie. What is it called?
Yeah, Midnight Express.
Midnight Express.
Yeah, obviously the guy knew how to work the system better than the guy in Midnight Express.
Last year you flew from Turkey, carrying a heavy load. Went back with lots of holes. Strange you never told anybody about it.
And then we proceeded to make the album called Guma, which was a major change in my life.
Oh yeah, that album
changed my life.
Changed my life also completely.
It was fantastic.
I was still thinking like a jazz man, instead of thinking like a rock hole, you know what I mean? But like songs like 20th Floor, that was pure rock and roll, you know? There was no 11ths, no, maybe a 7th, yeah. But, you know, there was no 11ths and minors in it.
That song, 20th Floor, I think was the first song I saw them play. And it's just extraordinary. Because it's got this tension and release. You know, it goes... Da-da-da! You know, it's got amazing
I've never thought of
construction.
It like
yeah, I just yeah. love it when it falls into place.
Came out a little bit clean for me. I wanted to be, you know, I wanted to snarl.
Those of us that had the privilege of actually seeing them, it was just the energy emanating from that stage with a song like that, as yeah. you say. That tension and release that they did. Mac without his shirt on, always without his shirt on, in pumping away in the background.
Yeah, no shirt headband. They're like Hendrix. They're very much a Hendrix sort of...
Totally. there's the image of Hilton.
Yeah, he's impeccably dressed. Sartorial elegance.
Always with a hat on.
Yeah.
Almost like a zoot suit kind of image. Catholic boy in the background, I don't know how he managed to actually, you know, assert himself in that band, because those other characters were so huge. But I mean, he asserted himself with his guitar playing, Gerard.
Yeah, I mean, listen to that. It's pumping, man.
We were operating in 1976 riots. So a lot of anger spilled over from what was happening around us. And it spilled into our pop songs, which was pop rock. It was the timbre of the day. We're in the Cape Flats. This bullshit happening there. People dying there.
The morning sun is sun, jangles the day. And people grudgingly the day's hard drudgery. But you must wait until the shadow lands.
Like Shadow LinkedIn is about the how they're gonna blow up a place, and he's having his last moments of life.
He's lucid.
He's lucid, and he's gonna die.
Your time is drawing near to the fatal confrontation. The plan must hold a while until the final score is settled. What do? You wait until the shadow lengthens. My mission is liked by more than few. I still have my work to do. I face the hunger just like you. Trap is set, but my demands have yet to be met.
That's why the next year we were in Amsterdam, playing for the anti-apartheid movement.
Oh, yes.
Because we didn't pull our punches. The lyrics are concerned.
It's interesting, Max should say that they didn't pull their punches as regards lyrics. I clearly remember Hilton saying when we chatted to him the other day that most of Mac's songs were about pumping.
Yeah, but Hilton's been a little bit disingenuous because they were, I mean, a lot of his songs were, but classic.
20th floor, 20th, whole damn night.
But classic rock writing is often, you know, and that's what he's drawing from. But as well, you know, the Genuines were like chameleons. So you had that. I remember watching them also thinking, how does this song now fit in after that breakneck speed, he goes into a ballad.
What's your opinion the morning after?
You see, another pumping song.
Crawling up tall, blue or blue, I'm asking you, you wonder why. I get a picture.
Able to do that, and then the political thing, they knew they had to stick some politics in because they were on, you know, they were
playing Jamisons.
Yeah, they wanted to make sure that they're on the right side of the fence.
Well, they were,
of course, but I mean, you had to make it clear, you had to hit home, and yeah, there's no ambiguity.
The struggle,
yeah. And so they did have,
do it right,
they did have a number of, yeah, you've got a Casper, I've got a stone.
You got a Casper, I got a stone. Pain and hatred won't leave us alone. I want my share, I want my sway, I want my say, I want it today. We gotta do it right, we really have to do it, have to do it right this time. We gotta do it right, we really have to do it, have to do it right this time. And the people all around the world gonna stop and say,
I'm struck how reconciliatory the lyric is. And prescient, understanding that this was 1987, when the new South Africa wasn't even a twinkle.
Simple, straightforward lyric, yeah. And, to struggle. But it's effective. I think their message was always effective.
But that's the only pure Guma song with an H on the Guma album without the H. Is The Struggle.
Is it?
Yeah, the rest are all rock songs.
That's
even,
right.
Even the song Guma without an H is a rock song.
That's very confusing.
And then there's the drug thing, of course. You know, it's got to do with the politics as well, but also it's got to do with the way they were living.
Yeah.
They were living on the edge. And Mac wrote a song, which is on the Guma album without the edge, called The Edge. Creatures are together.
Living on the edge, in many ways, all creatures run together out of a forest fire. I mean, everybody knows that. And in moments of danger, strangers become brothers. I was just quoting from different poetic structures that I came across in my life. On the edge, it's the only place to be. The edge was designed for you. In this order, ignoring disaster. Pressure makes a diamond of their lives. I was just saying, fuck all. But it made sense for the people of the time. The ECC and conscription campaign were living on the edge. Everybody was living on the edge. The Jamison's lot.
All on the edge, eh? Could I get arrested any minute?
That was the edge. I don't think there was a heavy philosophy behind it.
But it was very edgy. I mean, we were also taking drugs. So, I mean, that is edgy on its own, you know what I mean? You know, the cops could kick. In fact, they did. They kicked down our door twice already.
Yeah, but now, what really mystifies me about that, we weren't taking drugs. We were just smoking buttons.
That's
not a drug. That is just a fucking barbiturate.
Speak for yourself. But you know the mandrakes also fell into that category.
Yeah, but if you're colored, you can smoke mandrakes and your body can take.
It's too amazing. It's like Laurel Hardy.
Yeah, totally.
It was a culture of hecticness, man. You know what I mean? Mm. If it wasn't us smoking together, we would end up in fucking wrong places. Smoking with the merchants and then you get Owens that's just talking about jail. And I don't want to hear that. I want to hear talk about music.
Yes.
But you end up by these people, you know what I mean? Because you can't smoke at home.
Yes.
But I'm just saying that's when I mean drugs.
That is fantastic. I've never heard them articulate it that way. Because it's a funny thing with the drug stuff, whether or not to mention it. And one of the most striking things that you have is some film. You filmed them when recording one of the albums. I think it was Mr. Mac.
Yeah,
I think you filmed him making a pipe at the back there, and then Hilton runs off into the bush
with Robbie Johnson and Tony Cedros.
Yeah, and it was actually quite amazing. Kind of, it was like their break.
Yeah,
you know, they did this little
like
break,
tea break.
Yeah,
the button break.
What Kevin Gibson used to call 11s.
Which wasn't buttons.
No, it wasn't. It was mainly just weed. So Hilton the other day said, and I think this happens a lot with drugs, Hilton felt it normalized him. He felt he wasn't really a very normal person, but taking the drugs brought him into that's how you work. And I can sort of relate to that, being quite ADD and stuff. I know I drink a lot of coffee, which is, everyone has their, I remember Frank Zappa, someone said to him, you're anti-drugs, but why do you chain smoke and you drink coffee all day? And he said, that's not drugs, that's food. So I suppose that's what they're saying here.
Yeah, but it's just your opinion, man.
It's just, it's exactly. It's just, which it is. It's the way we all look at it. The trouble, though, and this goes back to something else that I feel is quite important, is it's the illegality. We wouldn't be so judgmental if it wasn't illegal. But they, like Hilton
taboos,
said...
Taboos, social taboos.
But like Hilton said, you had to mix with the drug crowd. So he just wanted to talk about music. But now you have to be with these guys who are out of it, and that's not what you want to do.
Hmm.
You want to be with the music. The illegality means that you're mixing with people who are now criminal or becoming criminal, or what you're doing is criminal. If that was removed and you could just take whatever drugs you needed to make your music, it's totally acceptable. In a funny way. Let's give a standing ovation to the murmuring waves. Take a look at us humans again and again. Those subtle encounters every now. So the band broke up. Hilton said that they didn't actually break up, they sort of fizzled apart slowly. But he always puts it down to when they went to Holland.
They were basically moved over there for a bit.
That's
Gerard
right.
was over there.
Everyone was there, but Ian didn't want to go. Or Ian had something else. He went somewhere else.
Yeah, he was playing with Tananas.
Yeah, that's right. He was playing with Tananas. And so he moved out of the Genuines. And without Ian, I think they felt they didn't have a foundation. And they tried. He said they tried a few drummers.
Well, they actually made a few albums after that.
They did, hey?
Yeah. As the Genuines. But it wasn't the same.
It wasn't the same.
No, without Ian's, it's not going to be the same.
And he said, they were like a family.
From 86 till 89, I think, basically, was the golden years of the Genuines.
Yeah. And Max said in the one interview, I think, you were family, you did that then, and then you do other stuff. You move into other, he wanted to score for orchestras and things and get into that kind of stuff. And
it's
so
like,
you move apart.
You know, sometimes it's time to move on.
Yeah, exactly.
And you start another life with somebody else.
I mean, same thing happened with the Beatles. That's quite a common thing with rock bands, in fact. I mean,
some you wish that it would happen to...
A bit sooner.
Yeah, like with the Rolling Stones.
Well, actually, it's funny. John Lennon said about the Rolling Stones, someone asked him about that, you know, the Beatles, would they have carried on? He said, look, we all grew up. We had families. It was time to move on. We don't want to hang around like the Rolling Stones and be eternal kids.
It's
brilliant.
It's a simple philosophy, but so accurate.
Going back now, myself coming out of UWC and working in a cultural study area, the people I met there who found the Genuines not only inspiring as a cultural force, but also studyable now. They've drifted into academia. I mean, I think I mentioned to you after doing my PhD chapters on the Shifty era, I battled to write about the Genuines simply because there was a lot of pressure from, you know...
Stepping on somebody else's turf.
Not only stepping on someone else's turf, but to deliver the right stuff. I think now that we've done this podcast, in fact, I'm in a better position to write about it. Definitely. Yeah. No, we've done now three interviews. We've seen Hilton three times. Mac, so there's been a lot since I did that. And of course, Mac has now passed. So we, there's a lot of meditation on his spirit and him.
Yeah.
I could tackle it now, but I couldn't then.
So certainly in terms of my interactions with musicians and the whole music field, from point of view as a producer and the point of view as a friend of musicians, there's probably no musician with a greater stature than Mac in my mind. It's not only from a musical point of view, but just from an essential, I have to come back to the energy thing again. You know, he just personified an absolute immersion in music for me.
And it was kind of his band, wasn't it?
He's the cog.
Yeah, he was the driving
force. But I mean, like the Happy Ships wasn't my band, but it coalesced around me because I was the person that had the energy to bring it together every time I was in Cape Town.
That's right.
The same with Mac.
It wouldn't have happened without you.
But every other musician was so important to the sound.
Yeah.
Same with the Genuine. Four very, very special musicians playing together for a short period in their musical career. Basically, that's the Guma album. And we look forward to doing a podcast about the Mr. Mac album, which has got a whole nother thing attached to it.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is a fifth member to the band, which is Mr. Mac himself. Another story, another day. It's been great talking about these guys.
And the rest is shifty.
And the rest is shifty.
You've been listening to The Rest is Shifty. For more information, go to shifty.co.za. Or for downloads, find us on shiftyrecords.bandcamp.com.